Good morning, or afternoon, or evening for that matter, whenever you're listening. Sorry about the strange introduction, but by the time Monday morning rolls around, I'm going to be off campus serving my civic duty. And so they say part of education is learning by example, and part of what we try to do is make you a good citizen. So you'll see that I'm not there because I am doing my civic duty, serving as a jury of peers, or as jury duty's been for me, usually sitting around for a long time and then being asked to go home and not doing anything terribly useful, but hey, it could be different this time. And for those of you who like to think ahead, yes, I am still on the hook for Wednesday, but I will give you more information when we get closer to that date and I know a little bit more. All right, so we want to go over the syllabus today as we normally would, and then the other fun thing about this being a continuation course, Roman numeral number 2, not Roman numeral number 1, is that we'll also then introduce some of the first topics today as well, because you're familiar with the syllabus and it's roughly the same, so we just have to hit the highlights. All right, so looking at the syllabus then, this is indeed Grove City College, and it is the spring semester, or for those of you who've just returned to Grove City from somewhere further south, the hopefully spring will arrive someday semester, 2025, and you are enrolled in Chemistry 352, Biochemistry Roman numeral number 2, our continuation of understanding what are the fundamental molecules of living systems, how do those molecules make up living systems both as enzymes and molecules for energy and structure. So same topic, just a slightly different set of themes. All right, so I am Kevin Shaw, and I would be waving at this point, although you can't see me. There's my contact information set out. Note the office hours or when you're likely to find me sitting in the office, but anytime that you can find me, whether it's in the office, in the building, in lab, or around campus, and you want to talk about biochemistry or anything else, please feel free to ask. Do not hesitate or be inhibited in any way. On the regular schedule, we will be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9 a.m. in STEM 155, so we have lab and class in the same place. One more year for me, or all you'll ever know. And then the laboratory section L, is Monday at 1 o'clock. Just as a preview, there is no lab today because, well, I'm not likely to be here. We can start next week, no problem, but do note that that is 1 o'clock, not a 2 o'clock start. We're moving back to the, or actually we did a long time ago, move back to the traditional laboratory time at Grove City College, 1 to 5. Many faculty complained that it was tough to teach a class at 11, have lunch, set up for lab, and be ready at 1. So for a very brief period, we moved the starts to 1:30. That lasted for about an hour, and now labs start at 2 o'clock, which you're expecting, but not this one. And the reason for that is truth in advertising. Some of the things that we'll do, some of the weeks in some of the activities, will take all 4 hours or more. And so we schedule that much time so that you are expecting to be there for 4 hours, and if you're done in 3 hours and 35 minutes, you are pleasantly surprised, as opposed to being incredibly frustrated if we start at 2 and it's now 5:30 and you've missed practice and dinner and other social obligations. So do note that that is Monday at 1 o'clock, but not starting this week, next week. All right, so following this course, the student will be able to write metabolic pathways for the synthesis and degradation of lipids and nucleic acids. Right, so that is very familiar to you, what we did in the fall semester for carbohydrates and amino acids. This semester we'll be looking at lipids and nucleic acids, and for those of you who like completion, those are the 4 classes of biological macromolecules, proteins, carbohydrates, lipids, and nucleic acids. You recognize that they all have their own biological and their own nutritive role, as you may be familiar. Once we understand lipids, then we can begin to talk about biochemical structures, and one of the most fundamental biochemical structures is the biological membrane, a bilayer of phospholipids which distinguish the inside of the cell from the outside of the cell in all living organisms, and then allow some living organisms to compartmentalize other components inside their cell so that they can carry out unique metabolism, as you might recognize from the chloroplast, for those of you who are fans of Rubisco, or from the mitochondria, for those of you who were awake at all last semester. You will be able to describe and predict the structures of nucleic acids under a variety of solution conditions. And that means not only the covalent structure, but nucleic acids have both polar and nonpolar components. They are very large molecules. So in the same way that we saw for proteins, that they adopt a higher order structure that we can describe, and that higher order structure has activity, nucleic acids are going to adopt higher order structure. In the case of RNA, that is also linked to a variety of activities. In the case of DNA, the higher order structure will vary. There's more than just B-form DNA that you know, depending on solution conditions, and so we will consider those equilibria according to the rules and laws of thermodynamics. It comes back. But then again, since it is Roman numeral number 2, you probably expected that. All right, we'll then identify and describe the structures and activities of DNA replication, maintenance, RNA processing, and protein synthesis and degradation. For those of you who remember your biology introduction, that is essentially the central dogma of molecular biology, but we're going to come at it again, this time when you already know it, but from the chemical perspective. What are the reactions involved? What are the molecules? What is the chemical logic behind it? Not only the biological implications, although we'll hit those as well. When you know a little bit about DNA, then there are a number of experiments which are based on DNA technology, and so we will describe some of those classics like DNA sequencing or the polymerase chain reaction, and then once we know the basics, we'll then apply them to novel problems, because like most of chemistry, when you have one technique in your back pocket, you can apply that in multiple ways to multiple problems, learning more, compounding your ability to learn, and building new things on top of that. So that's one of the great themes of experimental work, is you get these little tools and you can recombine each one of those little tools in order to help you or in order to assist you to do something new or something that you haven't done before. All right, so we will then describe the techniques of protein and nucleic acid structure determination at both high and low resolution. So much of our discussion has been predicated on the fact that we know the structures of molecules. We can say this is the structure of an enzyme. Here are the residues in the active site. They are oriented this way. We bind a substrate that way. It turns out that there are several methods for determining the structure of proteins and nucleic acids. We'll talk about some of those that are low resolution, like optical spectroscopy, that give us a feeling for maybe what's the inside or what's the outside, what's the secondary structure, all the way up to very high atomic resolution methods like X-ray crystallography and nuclear magnetic resonance. You thought you'd seen the last of your little peaks. Well, guess what? We're going to take NMR and turn it from a one-dimensional spectrum into a two-dimensional spectrum, so that's often fun for me, because before we can talk about attacking larger molecules, I have to build the concept of multidimensional NMR, 2D, 3D, 4D experiments for you. But that's a fish that we will fry when it is actually spring. We will describe the protein folding problem and analyze experimental evidence for the theories. One of the beautiful questions is, how does a protein go from being a polypeptide unstructured to adopting its native structure? That question is still open in many cases, and so we'll describe that from a historical perspective and give you practical experience. And then, of course, we have a lab component where you will perform basic experimental protocols such as micropipette measurement, solution preparation, titrations, and the handling of small quantities of biochemical reagents in spades this semester. All right, so those are the course objectives. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, a bit fewer than chemistry, 351, but we lump a lot of things together. All right, there are two required materials. The first of those is Nelson and Cox, Leninger's Principles of Biochemistry, same textbook as the fall, so no more cash outlay in the bookstore. You have everything you need. And then the other required material is access to the course website at https://biochemistry.prof, biochemistry.prof/352. And just a word of warning, the TLC has asked me to move some of the web applications from an older server which is running in their cluster where you saw protein.gcc.edu/chem351 last semester to somewhere else, and that somewhere else involves a complete rewrite, so 352 is not entirely finished, so you will find some things that are labeled coming soon if you start exploring, but I will be fleshing it out as we get there. Also note that it is a complete rewrite, so if something is not working, just say, hey, this isn't working, because I don't know if I can swash every bug just yet, and I've really been writing it over the last couple days, so it'll work. Famous last words. All right. Now, the thing that Grove City College students are most interested in, of course, is how do I get an A in this course, because I get nothing less than A's in any course. And that's the Grove City College way. So there are 1, 2, 3 unit exams. Those 3 unit exams are given during laboratories throughout the semester. And they make up the bulk of your grade. Then there is a final exam as scheduled by the registrar. And then the other component of your final course grade is laboratory. 1 out of the 3 credits were 25% from laboratory, so not particularly surprising. The only thing you'll note is there is not a formal writing assignment that appears in the course grade. However, as foreshadowing, there will be considerably more writing in laboratory. The theme this semester is that you are doing experiments much like you would do if you were assigned something as a graduate student, and in that way you'll be writing a paper after each one of the laboratories. So you'll probably end up doing more writing, but less outside reading. So 6 of 1, half dozen of another. And then the letter grade designations are 10 points to the letter grade. So 90 is the low A minus, 80 is the low B minus, 70 is the low C minus. But being Grove City College, we don't have to say anymore. All right, so turning on to page number 2, the general theme of the laboratory is to try and make this as close as possible to an authentic laboratory working experience where we can, in the context of just having a couple hours for lab. And the general theme is that I am going to give you a problem to solve and a bit of a protocol, and that is entirely up to you to fulfill, meaning that the first step of purification in a protocol is going to require a buffer. You have to go to the dry chemicals cabinet, pull those dry chemicals, to calculate how to make that buffer, prepare that buffer, adjust the pH, and then you're ready for the first step of purification. Exactly as it would be if you were starting something new in the laboratory and you hadn't ever done that before. You would have to make solutions in preparation. You would have to gather reagents and hardware, glassware, plasticware, micropipettes. And so everything starts from new, and we'll run that for a while, and then you get to start something new and something new and something new. But as a word of warning, the first one will be the most challenging because it is completely foreign and new. By the time you get into the third one or the fourth one, you'll say, hey, even though I'm doing a lot of work and starting out, I'm familiar, I know the general pattern or the n-gram, and so I can do this pretty well, which is, of course, what I'm hoping that you're able to do later on when someone says, hey, let's learn this thing, and they give you the responsibility of learning that, whether it is in an independent research project, in graduate school, or, perish the thought, it's often common for medical students to be given a particular disease treatment or diagnosis, forced to learn all about that, and then they teach their classmates, right? So being able to learn something new and step into a, I don't really know very much, but I have these tools, is a useful scheme. All right, so the general design of a laboratory is that we are going to run all experiments every week, meaning that you'll form a lab group, and your lab group will attack one particular problem, and there'll be another lab group which is working on something completely different. The classic reason for that pattern is that we need some of the larger pieces of equipment for some of these experiments, and I have only one copy of each one of those, right? So we will divide you up and attack that way. So that we can maximize our use of equipment and not have people waiting as long as possible, just waiting to make solutions or do calculations or other things like that. So the 4 laboratories that we'll run are GOT protein, a purification of glutamate oxaloacetate transaminase. Now I know I'm not allowed to talk about the previous semester, but glutamate oxaloacetate transaminase is an activity that you should be able to decode and write the reaction for at your leisure. And since I don't see any of you volunteering, I'm going to assume that you know exactly how to do that and thought that it was intuitively obvious and you didn't need to volunteer. But that is a protein purification from start to more or less finish entirely, something that we only got to dabble in the first semester. The second experiment is the isolation, quantitation, and physical characterization of DNA. Right, so you see we're hitting what is the sub-theme of this course, proteins and nucleic acids. With DNA, how is it purified? How do we understand how much we have? And then how does it behave, tying in with some of the student learning outcomes you've seen previously. Third experiment is the polymerase chain reaction. First to do it once with all of the math and understanding, and then we'll build something interesting on top of our ability to do the polymerase chain reaction. And then the fourth laboratory is the intersection of proteins and nucleic acids, looking at the activity of restriction endonucleases, enzymes which recognize specific sequences in DNA and cleave or break the phosphodiester bonds of DNA at those positions. All right. Practically, the 1, 2, 3, 4 labs, I'll explain. The first week we're together in lab. You'll assemble a laboratory group and get an assigned sequence of which order you'll be doing those, so you will have at least a week to prepare for all of them. So you don't have to walk in completely cold, because that means it's going to take you longer. And while I have scheduled 4 hours for laboratory, we're happy to stay. I'm happy to stay. You're unhappy to stay as long as you need to in order to do things. So in general, it's a good idea to prepare for laboratory so that when you come in, you know, okay, this is the first buffer I need. This is the first reagent I need to get out of the freezer. This is the first thing that we're going to do. We're going to move down this pathway in order to do things productively. So a little bit of outside prep is very useful. All right, laboratory grading is a little bit different than probably most of the other laboratories you've seen, in that it's graded on the satisfactory, unsatisfactory grade basis. And the way that this works is, following lab, the completion of one of the experiments, you'll have 2 weeks to write your corresponding paper, and then you bring it and turn it in. And if it is great, I give you a nice thumbs up. If there is something which is unsatisfactory, I mark every deficiency and hand it back to you. And your job then is to go back and correct any of those deficiencies, whether they're errors in calculation, missing components, incorrect answers, wrong theory, incomplete analysis, right? Anything, whatever it might be. And then once you fix those, you bring them back to me, your changes, and I look at them again, and we progressively make your paper satisfactory throughout the semester. On that back and forth, there is no time limit, so it is quite possible that we get down to study day and you're still working on labs. That's quite all right. You'll probably want to make them more timely, but it's not a problem if it drags on and on and on, because we really want to learn in this experience, and part of working collaboratively is that you do your part and you bring it to the other people in the group, and they're going to have their own ideas and views, and they're going to make revisions and ask you to make those changes. So we're going to simulate that. Or for those of you who are familiar with the peer review process, it's very much like sending your paper off for referee comments, where two other scientists are going to read it and say, this is wrong, that's not described well. Please make these changes. All right. So, laboratory reports are the vast majority of your laboratory grade. Everything else comes just a little bit later. All right. So, one of the things that we need to think about is laboratory citizenship, because you are going to be working with a particular set of reagents. Sometimes there's overlap with other groups, sometimes not. But there's certainly overlap with other people in your group. And so, if you take something off the shelf and just leave it sitting by the balance when you're done with it, no one is going to be very happy with you, because they're not going to be able to find it in dry chemical storage. They're going to come to me and I won't find it in dry chemical storage, and I'll start to look around the room, right, until we can find it. And that takes time, and right, you all want to be able to finish laboratory timely. And so it's frustrating when the things which have homes, right, don't get back to those homes. So I encourage you to be a very, very good lab citizen. Generally, the scientific community is fairly small, and if you end up working in science, there will be a few people that you work very closely with day in and day out. There'll be a larger group that you work with, not quite so closely, but regularly. And then you'll find that in a particular field, there are a set of researchers, and it's in your best interest to be in their good graces whenever you can, by responding to their requests timely, right? Making their lives easy, because they will also make your lives easy as well. You know, think family. If you are kind to your siblings, they are kind to you. And if you are unkind to your siblings, they generally make your life challenging. All right. There are some things that you can do, like washing the glassware and leaving it out to dry. Right? You don't have to go full dry and put it away. You can just leave it around. And so anything that you see hanging above the sinks, you can assume is clean. We are biochemistry lab rules, not organic chemistry lab rules. Working in organic lab, you assume that all glassware is dirty, and you prepare it for your work. And if you don't do that, it's to your own peril, because there's something hanging around that's reactive previously. All right. Please, full appropriate lab attire. Safety goggles. There will be some times where you are handling things which are a serious potential hazard, and I will point those out. So be prepared with safety goggles for those times. The polymerase chain reaction, very small volumes and not very dangerous. But some things definitely serious, acids, bases, and the like. All right. Laboratory reports are a group activity. So you finally get to have the group lab report you've been asking for a long time. And it is a full paper. That is, there is a title, and it's not simply DNA isolation, right? There is a full title with the theme, the experimental system, and what you've learned. An abstract, an introduction. Now, for the introduction, you'd normally do a large literature search. You can largely constrain that to the materials that I'll be providing you with. You don't have to go out and read the literature in order to write two or three pages of introduction. Then there is a results section where you present your data, and a discussion or conclusion section where you interpret each piece of data in light of what you've seen or what you set out to learn in that laboratory activity. All right. General pattern is 2 weeks following lab. However, if 2 weeks after you finish your lab is an exam, there is no double jeopardy. So it ends up being 3 weeks. You always have longer than 2 weeks if there is a conflict. And then the other bit of your laboratory grade comes from your laboratory notebook. Keep going in the laboratory notebook you used in the fall. If you left it with me, I still have it, and we'll bring it to lab the first time. And if you've lost it, just say so, and I'll bring some extras to lab that you can start again. Everything in the bound notebook, glued or stitched, number the pages, write an index in the front, everything in ink, and you'll be using your experimental notebook considerably more extensively this semester, largely because you're making all the reagents, you're designing some of the experiments, so volumes, concentrations, all those things need to be recorded. It'll be much more realistic, and everything begins with a date. Each topic is introduced with a brief statement, very brief, and it's largely pretty clear from what I write. All calculations and data should be entered. There will be electronic resources, so if you are collecting instrumentation data, files there, and note in your lab notebook where to find those files, corresponding names, folders, etc. And then your laboratory notebook is, again, a record of what you've done. Typically, students are going to want to take the laboratory experiment and say, okay, the two of us are going to go and we're going to make this buffer. The two of you go and make that buffer. Once we have those two buffers, we'll come back together. And then these two will start on purification and those two will make the third buffer. Right. So your lab notebook is not complete. It doesn't have what the other people do. Please don't try to copy what they do. Don't want to be tedious, but want you to have the opportunity to use a laboratory notebook. And then the laboratory notebook is due on or before study day. Or again, you can bring it to the final exam, although the final exam is not very long after study day, so don't think that's going to be salvation for you. Wink, wink. All right, the laboratory schedule, January 13th, which is Monday, could be today, could be in the future, could be in the past, depending on when you're listening. No laboratories, we will not start because I'm unlikely to be here. On January the 20th, I will go through introducing each of the four laboratories and their background documents. Please note, if you search the website for them, you won't find them yet because that part I'm still writing. But by January 20th, it should be good to go. And you'll see what we have. And I'll walk through each one of those, giving you the outline of the basic theme, describing some of the experiments, and in particular noting where things can go horribly wrong and where you need to pay really close attention. And then beginning January 27th, you're in the lab for your first experiment, week one, and February 3rd, back in the experiment for week number two on that experimental approach. Some of the experiments are week one and week two, 3 to 4 hours working very hard. Some of them are a little bit shorter and or have more outside work, but they pretty much fill 2 weeks, give or take a bit. Then February 10th is a reserve for exam number one. Do note it's not a 4-hour exam. They don't get longer in the second semester, but our lab line is long, so if you really want to sit there for 4 hours, you may. All right, February 17th, rotation 2, week 1. February 24th, rotation 2, week number 2. March 3rd, then, is conveniently spring recess. We're through two labs, which means we are halfway through the semester. Everything's gone swimmingly. It's a little bit tougher in March because the 10th will start rotation number 3, week number 1, but we have to stop for St. Patrick's Day to take the second exam because that's where we'll be in the lecture content. And then we come back after 1-2 weeks and finish that experiment. Then the 31st of March and the 7th day of April, that is rotation number 4, weeks 1 and 2. We have our third exam on the 14th day of April. The 14th day of April is just before, is the Monday before Easter recess, which means the 21st we are not in lab because we're not going to be here on Monday, so that's Easter recess. And then the 28th is the week of study day. Gulp. The barely spring semester, so we won't have any laboratories then, but that will give you time to catch up on anything you haven't written, anything of the corrections that you haven't written, and or finishing up that laboratory notebook. All right, so lab looks a little bit different. We'll have next week to explain that and introduce it, give you a better feeling, so don't be terribly nervous just yet. If that seems a little daunting, it's lots of fun. Note, of course, that is professorial fun, not student fun. All right, so the course policies. Readings from the text are listed on the course website for every day. In addition to those, there's sometimes background reading from the literature. We're moving into being more interested in how we learn things, as opposed to having to spend all our time introducing molecules and principles and enzymes. We're more comfortable with that. It can go a little bit more quickly. And so we turn our attention to how we learn about the world, and sometimes that doesn't make it into textbooks in any reasonable detail. So there will be some outside readings. There are also a number of outside podcasts which relate a particular topic in this course to how it is being studied today or through the last few years. So I'd encourage you to listen to those as well, give you something to do while on the treadmill or, you know, strolling up and down between upper and lower campus for the apartment dwellers. In addition, there are suggested problems. Note that they're not ready yet. They are changing in format as well as possibly identity, but we'll get to those very soon. And so it's a good idea to work through those. Some of them are in the textbook. Some of them are extra textbook-like. So look at those. And then the examinations we've already talked about are in lab, along with the comprehensive final examination. So don't be surprised by that. And if we turn the page to page 4, hey look, final exams as required by the registrar at the time required by the registrar. So there will be a final exam. And again, the amount of time you have for the final exam is shorter than any of the unit exams, but that's a biochemistry peculiarity. It's a good idea for you to be in class. It's a really good idea for you to be in lab. But there's the attendance policy. Accommodations will be made if necessary, and then it is imperative that you do your own academic work original for this course, or pages 50 through 53 of the 2024-2025 Grove City College Bulletin, if you'd like that spelled out in full detail. All right, on to page number 5, which is the schedule of topics. Let's see what's there and what we expect to find out. Well, today we will introduce the lipids. You didn't think you were getting away with just a description of the syllabus, did you? No, we'll start talking about lipids today. And a general context. And then one of the things that lipids are used for is they're a very good store of energy, primarily because they are highly reduced carbon and hydrogen. Or many of them are saturated with hydrogen or awfully close to being saturated, which means that we have a long way to go in oxidation. So fatty acid oxidation is our next topic. And unlike central metabolism, when we're dealing with what would we call be called peripheral metabolism, something outside of glycolysis in the citric acid cycle, we can often identify diseases that are related to fatty acid metabolism. And they are interesting to consider, both as a disease state, but they're also illustrative in the way that we understand that disease state based upon what we know about the biochemical reactions. So we'll talk about some diseases of fatty acid metabolism after the first week. Then we'll talk about the biosynthesis of the lipids. Where do they come from? Oxidation, of course, where do they go? And then, the beginning on the 27th of January, it is Membrane Week. Right, you've heard of Shark Week. Well, this is Membrane Week. It is equally fun, but, fewer teeth. Introduce the biological membranes, their dynamic, and their transport. And that is it formally for lipids, done by the end of January. And then we introduce the nucleotides. Those would be nitrogenous base, sugar, and phosphate. At least one of those, ATP, reasonably well at this point. But we'll introduce the others. Then where do they come from and where do they go? Right, biosynthesis and degradation of the nucleotides. Lots of fun chemistry there. And, unfortunately my hands are tied because there's a lot of overlap with metabolism that you already know. And that is then the end of unit number one. So unit number one, that exam is going to look very much like exams from the fall semester because it's primarily about intermediary metabolism and how do we build molecules and how do we take them apart. Lots of structures, lots of enzymes, lots of reactions. That will be familiar. And then beginning on the 10th of February, we start in with the question of DNA structure. DNA structure then leads us to RNA structure, and once we know a little bit about that, we can talk about chemistry of the nucleic acids. And then we're on largely to what is a recapitulation of the central dogma of molecular biology, with the caveat that we're going to be a bit more chemical than you've probably seen it before. And on February 19th, then we talk about genomes, and on the 21st of February, you'll know that there is a small lowercase italicized M in front of the topic aligning sequences. What that means is that that topic is not particularly dependent on what we've seen before. We've talked about enough that you'll understand it, but it is a unique lecture on a particular method. And so how do we make local alignments between protein and nucleic acid sequences? And or, for those of you who are in the know, how does BLAST actually do what BLAST does when it finds a local alignment for you? All right, DNA packing, how we take a very large molecule and compress it in physical space such that it can be separated among dividing cells. Then a methodology on running gel electrophoresis. Then DNA replication, right, is one DNA making other DNAs. We're off for spring recess. Then we come back to DNA sequencing and the polymerase chain reaction, right? Depending on, both of those depend on knowing the structure and the activity of DNA polymerase, the major enzyme of DNA replication. So we can build those two, and then we're done with the second unit. Thereby, is that Pi Day? 3.14, March 14th. All right. Then DNA repair, recombination, DNA-dependent RNA synthesis, you'd know that as transcription, RNA processing, splicing, capping, poly-A tailing, protein synthesis is the activity of the ribosome, and then proteins, once they're synthesized, may end up in other organelles in eukaryotic systems, or ultimately they are going to be degraded, and so that's protein targeting, putting it in other organelles, or outside the cell for every cell, and protein degradation. Where do the proteins go? When it's time to recycle them back into amino acids? And if we could talk about the first semester, then we would say, where do those amino acids go? Citric acid cycle. But I'm not allowed to say that. All right. And then it's largely methods until the end of class with, of course, introducing a few interesting topics. But recombinant protein expression, how do we use microbes that we can control and grow large numbers of in very small volumes in order to make large amounts of protein that we would like? That gives us the benefit for structural studies, for studying enzymes. If we have a large amount of enzyme, we can do more experiments than if every couple days we have to go back and find an organism, isolate a few copies of that enzyme, right? We have more power the more we have and we can study. Absorbent spectroscopy, and there are multiple variations on absorbent spectroscopy. We'll talk about a few. Emission spectroscopy, again, we'll focus on one in particular. Then nuclear magnetic resonance of proteins, although as alluded to earlier, the first lecture is largely going to be about multidimensional Fourier transform NMR, and then we'll talk about how you actually apply that to proteins. And, well, unfortunately, we split the second and third unit right after NMR before we get to X-ray crystallography. It'd be fun to have them together, but hey, there's a final exam coming. All right, then April 14th and 16th, just before Easter recess, is X-ray crystallography of proteins. And then after Easter recess, it is protein folding, either the big question, the methodologies, some of the methodologies, or the disease states related to protein folding deficiencies. And then study day is going to be May 1st, that Thursday, and your final exam is at 8 a.m. on the second day of May. So remember, lab notebooks, if you want to turn them in after study day, it's not long until the final exam. So don't count on having days or weeks like you may have had in the fall. All right. At this point, I would ask if there are any questions, but you'll have to address those questions to me some other time or in some other way. But now, since we have a bit left on the wall clock, let's begin to think about the molecules that we want to talk about first, and those molecules are the lipids. And what's fun about the lipids is that they are macromolecule number 3, and there are molecules which are, how to say this politely without being too derogatory to the lipids, their characteristic is their chemical composition, not necessarily their structure or their function. In the way that, excepting maybe proline, all the amino acids looked similar, and the carbohydrates, they had a key theme. Lipids are primarily carbons and hydrogens with a little bit of oxygen thrown in to hold everything together, but there's a wide range of structures that can be made out of carbon and hydrogen, reference organic chemistry, and so there are a couple different categories structurally of the lipids, and then each one of those categories may map to multiple functional categories as well, and so lipids are largely those molecules which are primarily insoluble in water and made up of carbon and hydrogen. Not necessarily are they a functional category or a unique chemical structural category. So when we think structurally, there are three classic variations on lipids. We can build other things from these variations, but the three variations are the triglycerides, the phospholipids, and the sterols. Triglycerides, classic fatty acid, glycerol, fatty acid, same glycerol, fatty acid, same glycerol, or glycerol and 1, 2, 3 fatty acids, hence the tri in glycerides. Phospholipids are often but not always based on glycerol as well. They have two hydrocarbons, right, fatty acids that look very similar to the triglycerides. The other, glycerol, is derivatized often with a phosphate group and then some form of a head group, right, giving it a unique characteristic. And then the sterols are fused ring systems, don't look either like the triglycerides or the phospholipids. Now, of course, when you look at the final structure, that doesn't necessarily give you a feeling for how they get there or where they go. So there is some similarity that we'll bring out as we look at the synthesis and degradation of each one of those. In functional terms, lipids are certainly involved in energy storage. Energy storage is very important. We talked about making glucose, storing that long term. We can also then take reduced carbon and polymerize it into fatty acids. They are considerably more reduced, and so as they're oxidized, they will release more energy. Since it is winter, you can think about your friends who are hibernating. Okay. The organisms that you like that hibernate being, of course, that we've called a return to college, you don't get the chance to hibernate any longer. Sorry about that. So energy storage is really big. Some of the lipids have a primarily structural role. Like discussion of the phospholipids, you generally think of them as being the components of the biological membrane. Lipids are also chemical signals. If you remember or have heard of the endocrine system, there is an endocrine gland which is sensing some physiological variable and will release a small chemical communicator in response to changes in that. Sometimes those signals are peptides, other times they are derived from lipids, and in general when we see the lipid hormones, they fall into some unique classes or activities. Often they are involved in creating longer-term, slower responses, particularly gene expression, as opposed to peptide hormones like insulin regulating blood glucose rather immediately. Again, depending on the time of the day, it could or could be the case that you just had a couple donuts and a cup of coffee with cream and three sugars, in which case your blood glucose is climbing, and the pancreas says, no, 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 we can't have this. Right, we need to bring the blood sugar down quickly. Steroid hormones typically are longer acting than that. They're not immediate responses, but they are changes in body plans, long-term structural sorts of things. And then also, some lipids will be cofactors for enzymes or other things that get categorized as vital amines. Remembering, of course, that not all vital amines or all vitamins are actually amines. The designation came largely because they were isolating the B vitamins and they got the mashup name. All right, so let's take them roughly in the functional order or the structural order, or since they overlap enough, we'll just talk about each one of them in turn, both structure and function. All right, so in terms of the triglyceride, the basic molecule that looks like a lipid is something called the fatty acid. And the fatty acid is a single carboxylic acid attached to a long hydrocarbon chain. General designations for these molecules is that we count the number of carbons and we identify them as C10, C12, C16, C18, C20. To give you an idea of the length, each one of those has a unique name as well. We won't be terribly excited about those unique names, but just identify them by the number of carbons. Hint, hint, wink, wink. They tend to come in even number of carbons extensively. And once we get to their synthesis and breakdown, you'll see why that is. It should be very familiar. Fatty acids at their shortest are 4 carbons long. They top off at about 36 carbons in length, and so if you're familiar with crude oil and the distillates that you get out of crude oil, you don't usually have molecules which are larger than about 30 carbons long, because crude oil is the remnants of organisms that lived previously, and they only made 36 carbon hydrocarbons. All right, we can also see a fatty acid which is unsaturated, right? So I'll draw the same thing again, this time unsaturated. And that is, we have one double bond. This one would be a monounsaturated, although we can also see polyunsaturateds. Typically, fatty acids, 12 to 24 carbons are what you're thinking about. And when we have a double bond, we use the delta and a superscript number to tell us from the carboxylic acid carbon number 1 where that double bond falls. And so you'll see that, write that nomenclature. When we're dealing with fatty acids which are saturated, they tend to form solids at room temperature, think butter. When we have unsaturated fats, they don't pack quite as tightly, so they are less dense. They tend to, at room temperature, be liquids, think olive oil. And so you can begin to understand their macro-level properties based on just a little bit of chemical knowledge. If we take one molecule of glycerol and couple that with 1, 2, 3 fatty acids, we can make a triglyceride. Please note that while I'm drawing a triglyceride, I'm not going to draw a triglyceride to full actual size because it's a very large molecule in terms of the number of carbons. We'll keep it artificially short. And then between each fatty acid and glycerol, there is an ester, which links those together. Vertebrates or mammalian vertebrates, the adipose tissue will store triglycerides largely as anhydrous, insoluble droplets, so not a lot of water required for fat storage because, right, there's not a lot in that molecule which is going to interact very favorably with water. I would be making the Vulcan hand gesture for the four molecular forces if you could see me. All right. And so then those molecules can be formed. They can also be released such that we get free fatty acids and glycerol. Those fatty acids can be oxidized, as we'll talk about later on this week, hopefully in person, but no guarantees. All right. The phospholipids are very similar in their structure in that, so the phosphatidyl X's are based on glycerol. They're also sphingolipids as opposed to phospholipids, which are based on sphingosine, a slightly different adapter molecule. But they usually have one saturated fatty acid, one unsaturated fatty acid. And then the third hydroxyl group is derivatized with a phosphate group and some other derivative. And that then gives us a molecule which we would describe as amphipathic, having a distinct polar end, the phosphate and whatever that head group is, and a distinct nonpolar end, the two long hydrocarbons. And so it behaves in a particular orientation with respect to water where the phosphate and the head group interact very favorably, the tails interact very negatively, and that gives rise then to the structure of the membrane, one to roughly parallel planes of phospholipids with the tails together in the center, anhydrous, and the polar head groups to the outside interacting on either side very favorably with water. Depending on what the head group is, there are a number of different variations on the head group that gives both rise to a particular phospholipid by name and overall a net charge. So some of the phospholipids have net negative charges, others are neutral, in that their head group has a positive charge. And so there's phosphatidic acid, where the, as you might guess from the name, the group there is just a hydrogen, can be dissociated like an acid. That one's going to have a net charge of -1. Phosphatidylserine, like an amino acid serine. One negative charge, one positive charge, one negative charge on the phosphate group, so -2 + 1, net is -1. And then choline, you may have seen that one on an exam question somewhere. Choline is a nitrogen with a formal positive charge that cancels out the negative charge from the phosphate group, giving us a phospholipid which is overall neutral. All right, and then the final structural molecule that we need to talk about is cholesterol. Cholesterol has this structure. It is 1,2,3 fused 6-membered rings, one fused 5-membered ring. We've got a couple methyl groups, one hydroxyl group, a double bond, and a much longer hydrocarbon chain. Cholesterol is involved in a number of things. It's the basis for all the steroid hormones. It is also then going to be incorporated into the membrane, primarily because the hydroxyl group is out, the rest is in with the phospholipids, and because cholesterol has a bulky planar structure, that's going to prevent the phospholipids from packing tightly, such that when biological organisms encounter the cold, like you might walking to class later today, or in the future, or in the past, depending on when you're listening, you don't go crystalline, right? You stay liquid and flexible, making it useful for those activities when you're outside and working. All right, the wall clock tells me that we are getting close to the end. So that is the introduction of biochemistry, Roman numeral number 2, or chemistry 352. A little bit different in the lab, but we will have more time to talk about that. General same themes, intermediary metabolism, and then metabolism for the flow of genetic information, and then a lot of methodology thrown in and around that so that we can begin to think about how these things are learned in the laboratory, how you can do a rather basic experiment and add on to that in order to learn something new. And then we introduced a few of the lipids. Remember that they are a category which is primarily based on their behavior with respect to water, Right? They are hydrophobic, not necessarily on the same structure. So while triglycerides and phospholipids share something similarly in the fatty acids and a glycerol adapter molecule, do note that cholesterol, while still a lipid, looks very different from that. If I am back on Monday, if I'm back on Wednesday, I will let you know, and we'll have class as normal. And if I'm not going to be back by Wednesday at 9 a.m., still serving my civic duty, I will let you know, and there'll probably be another canned lecture of this style. But until that time, enjoy the first couple days of school, settle in, catch up with friends, and I will talk to you in the future.